The headlines this hour. Israel continues to target the Gaza Strip with deadly air raids, prompting fresh retaliatory strikes from Palestinian resistance fighters. Expert-level talks resume for a second day in Vienna as part of negotiations for the removal of sanctions against Iran. Plus, Chinese fighter jets and warships engage in major maritime drills around Taiwan following the U.S. House Speaker's controversial visit to the island. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. More Palestinians fall victim to Israeli strikes as the regime continues to hit the besieged Gaza Strip for the second consecutive day. The latest attacks have killed 5 people, bringing to 15 the number of those who have lost their lives since Friday. Israeli attacks have also wounded over 110 people over the past 2 days. Tel Aviv has vowed to press ahead with its aerial operations. Palestinian resistance groups have also continued their retaliatory attacks. The Islamic Jihad says it has fired dozens of rockets at Israeli towns and military sites. Palestinian resistance groups have ruled out any truce, stressing the regime must fully pay for the price for its actions. Ashraf Shannon joined us earlier to fill us in with an update on the situation in the Gaza Strip.
While Palestinian resistance factions continue to fire retaliatory rockets towards the Israeli regime and also towards Israeli military posts around the Gaza Strip, Israel also continues to attack Gaza. They bombed at least 2 buildings today, completely destroying them and displacing dozens of more families. Yesterday, when they assassinated top Islamic Jihad commander Taseer Jabari, they hit an apartment building that houses over 100 families. All these people left the building fearing for their lives. Meanwhile, the Gaza Sol power generating plant stopped working at 12 noon today due to lack of fuel because Israel has been closing the crossings into the Gaza Strip since Tuesday and not allowed fuel to enter the Gaza Strip. While the Gaza's main hospital, the Shifa Medical Complex, announced that it could stop its services within 72 hours because of lack of fuel and lack of electricity and also a lack of medical supplies.
Mick Napier from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign says Israeli politicians often compete in killing the highest number of Palestinians in order to succeed in their elections.
The elect in the past, the political competition in the Zionist bloc has often led to attacks on Gaza, has often led to bloodletting. Indeed, during two elections back, Benny Gantz, the moderate, competed with Netanyahu by producing an electoral video asking for Israelis to vote for him. And he included pictures, videos of Israel, of Palestinian funerals, coffins. And in it, he said he had bombed Gaza back to the Stone Age, and you should vote for him because he would kill more Palestinians. He actually had, during the 2 or 3 minute video, a little counter in the corner of his video saying how many Palestinians he had been responsible for killing during a particular attack on Gaza. It's been a constant of Israeli politics and behavior that they use extreme naked violence against the Palestinian people, quite simply because there's really nothing to negotiate. Either the Palestinians submit, in which case they will continue to be dispossessed every day, every week. There will be more land taken from Palestinians for exclusively Jewish occupation. So if they don't resist, they'll be dispossessed. And if they resist, the Israelis only know the language of violence and they must be crushed. And that's what we're seeing at the moment.
Condemnations are pouring in following Israel's fatal airstrikes in the besieged Gaza Strip. The Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi says the attacks once again showed the Israeli regime is seeking aggression and occupation. Also, the IRGC's chief commander, Hossein Salami, says the Zionist regime will pay another heavy price for its recent crimes. Turkey has also strongly condemned the air raids. Ankara says it is unacceptable to kill civilians. Yemen's National Salvation Government and Ansarullah movement condemned the Israeli airstrikes as well. Ansarullah also reaffirmed Palestinians' right to respond to the aggression. Russia and the EU have called for maximum restraint in Gaza. Qatar, Jordan, Algeria, Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement, Iraq's Kataib Hezbollah group, and the Organization of Islamic Cooperation have all condemned the Israeli aggression. Talks between Iran and the P4 Plus One on the 2015 deal have resumed in the Austrian capital, Vienna. Negotiations are being held at the expert level. The two sides are trying to narrow their differences on major issues. Iran's deputy foreign minister and top negotiator Ali Bagheri-Kani arrived in the Austrian capital on Thursday. The Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, known as the JCPOA, was derailed after Washington withdrew from it in 2018 and then reimposed sanctions on Iran. The remaining parties have held several rounds of talks since April of last year in an attempt to revive the deal. Taiwan accuses the Chinese army of simulating an attack on the island as Beijing continues major maritime drills around Taiwan. This following a controversial visit by the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to Taipei. On Saturday, Chinese fighter jets flew near Taiwan and warships sailed in the Taiwan Strait as part of the drill. Taiwan says some of those planes and ships crossed the demarcation line that divides the strait, which Beijing does not recognize. Taiwan says it mobilized air and land patrols and deployed land-based missile systems in response. China's drill is seen as part of the country's military and political response to Pelosi's trip to the self-ruled island, which China claims as its own territory. Beijing says the trip interfered with Chinese internal affairs and undermined the country's sovereignty and territorial integrity.
With her trip to Taiwan this week, Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives Nancy Pelosi set off a firestorm in offending China. From the self-governing territory, Pelosi criticized Beijing and its leadership, while carefully outlining the limitations of the U.S. commitment to defend the island.
In the Congress, House and Senate, Democrats and Republicans are committed to the security of Taiwan in order to have Taiwan be able to most effectively defend themselves. But it also is about our shared values of democracy and freedom, and how Taiwan has been an example to the world in that regard.
China had warned the U.S. and Pelosi against the visit, as it views Taiwan as a breakaway province that will one day rejoin a one China. In response to Pelosi's Taiwan visit, China's People's Liberation Army on Thursday began the largest military exercises targeting Taiwan in decades.
Tension in the situation across the Taiwan Strait is solely caused by the U.S. side. The root cause is Pelosi's selfish and willful interference with Taiwan, which seriously violates the One China principle. The Chinese government has the right to take all necessary and justified actions to firmly safeguard its national sovereignty and territorial integrity.
In South Korea, Pelosi met with the Speaker of the National Assembly. Seoul has been careful to balance its U.S. military alliance and relations with its largest trading partner, China. Pelosi spoke with South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol on the phone, but the two did not meet, an outcome widely viewed as a snub of the third-ranked U.S. official. House Speaker Pelosi later stopped in Japan, where she met with Prime Minister Fumio Kishida. China later Friday announced sanctions against Pelosi and the suspension on several issues of cooperation with the United States. Frank Smith, Seoul.
A series of drills across six zones surrounding Chinese Taipei. Conventional missile firepower assault in the waters east of Taiwan. More than 100 warplanes, including fighters and bombers, as well as over 10 destroyers and frigates. These are the largest military drills that China has conducted perhaps ever, showing its awesome military might. This level of force displayed in such a manner shows how angry China is at the U.S. and the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit.
Since 1949, that Taiwan is an integral part of China. And they see that as China has moved from being under the control of imperialist powers to becoming a strong independent nation, that they intend to exercise sovereignty over all of their historical, geographical range, including Taiwan.
Ironically, the G7 group of countries and the High Representative of the European Union have now issued a statement condemning these exercises, claiming that they threaten the stability of the region. In this instance, the European side has now backed the U.S. when it comes to its stance against China. Is this another Ukraine conflict scenario playing out? China sees this as a provocation, since it is endorsing and encouraging pro-separatists and pro-independence forces on the island.
Chinese made their strikes, probably using our visit as an excuse. Let me close by saying this. The Chinese have tried to isolate Taiwan. They may try to keep Taiwan from visiting or participating in other places, but they will not isolate Taiwan by preventing us to travel there.
There's no question that after U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit, the relationship between the U.S. and China has nosedived. China has said that it was ending cooperation with the U.S. on a whole host of issues, things such as climate change, anti-drug efforts, and even military issues. There may be other actions that China will take that are not very clear at this point.
China has in the past viewed Chinese Taipei as part of its territory. It has also publicly stated that it may take it by force one day if necessary. This is where the U.S. and now Europe come in. Just like Ukraine, both are warning China against any thoughts of a takeover, which parallels the conflict in Ukraine.
The People's Liberation Army has now declared 7 restricted zones near Taiwan and say that they will extend a range of military exercises through Monday. These provocative actions are a significant escalation.
I think the issue of provoking China is this. The United States does not have as part of its sort of thinking that somebody is going to be our equal. We have in the Western Pacific this amazing amount of military. Well, China happens to be there. You know, that's part of the world that they're in. And I think that as time goes on, and they have been very clear about this, that they're not prepared to cede American military hegemony to us in the Western Pacific much longer.
But China is not Ukraine. If the military display of China is anything to go by, the U.S. provocations against China and Europe's support come at a dangerous time when the world economy is on the precipice. The U.S. anti-China stance and China's maneuvers are taking place along some of the world's busiest shipping routes. Let's not forget, the global supply of vital semiconductors and electronic equipment produced in East Asia are in this region. Additionally, more than 60% of global maritime trade and more than 22% of the total global trade passes through the South China Sea. Is the U.S. and its European allies willing to risk this?
The United Nations Secretary General says the world is playing with a loaded gun as a new arms race is gaining momentum among global powers. Antonio Guterres made the comment at an annual memorial ceremony marking the 77th anniversary of the U.S. atomic bomb attack on the Japanese city of Hiroshima. Guterres also highlighted the need for global nuclear disarmament, saying that the only way to eliminate nuclear threats is to have no nuclear weapons at all. He made the remarks as the Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida and local authorities were also present at the event. In 1945, the U.S. bombed the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki with atomic bombs, killing more than 220,000 people. The U.S. is the only country to have used weapons of mass destruction during that war. Muslims in Pakistan and other countries across the world mark the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein's 6-month-old son on the International Day of Ali Asghar. The third Shia Imam, Hussein ibn Ali, and his family and followers were ruthlessly martyred in the Battle of Karbala in 680 AD.
Mourners in Karachi commemorated the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein's youngest child, who was not spared by the enemy forces.
The 6-month-old Ali Asghar, the youngest son of Imam Hussein, was martyred by the forces of Yazid. The Battle of Karbala and Imam Hussein's sacrifices for righteousness and freedom are still a source of inspiration for Muslims around the world.
Mothers who brought their babies along paid tribute to Ali Asghar on the first Friday of the Islamic month of Muharram and mourned the 6-month-old son of Imam Hussein.
What had the 6-month-old done? We are out on the streets recalling the message of that innocent child of Imam Hussein, that we will always stand against the tyrant of the time. We will always stand shoulder to shoulder with the oppressed, no matter what.
Special eulogies and rituals were performed to commemorate the incident where Ali Asghar was killed with an arrow shot in his throat in the plains of the Iraqi city of Karbala.
We are commemorating the martyrdom anniversary of Ali Asghar, the youngest martyr of Karbala, who teaches us the lessons of readiness and sacrifice in the face of injustice and brutality.
Ali Asghar was martyred while he was in the arms of his father, Imam Hussein, who was pleading for water to quench the thirst of his little baby. The grandson of Prophet Muhammad and his companions sacrificed their lives but refused to pledge allegiance to the unjust Umayyad Caliph Yazid. Muhammad Turi, Karachi.
And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Wahid deshne barilebe teshne barilebe teshne barilebe teshne.
Mournful is the earth as heaven starts to cry, water doubts its worth as lips begin to dry. Listen to the silence, it breaks with a sad goodbye. Amid the drums of war is a mother's lullaby. Hussein, 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 I cry for you in pain, I cry for you. I cry for you in
pain. In the limelight. Former U.S. President Donald Trump's legal team is in direct communication with Justice Department officials, the first sign of talks between the two sides as the criminal probe into January 6, 2021 accelerates, sources familiar with the matter have told CNN. The talks revolve around whether Donald Trump would be able to shield conversations he had while he was president from federal investigators. The article you're about to hear has been written by CNN journalists Caitlin Pollance, Kara Scannell, Gabby Orr, and Kirsten Holmes. The article has been published by CNN and is titled Trump Lawyers in Talks with Justice Department about January 6 Criminal Probe. Former President Donald Trump's legal team is in direct communication with Justice Department officials, the first sign of talks between the two sides as the criminal probe into January 6, 2021 accelerates, sources familiar with the matter have told CNN. The talks revolve around whether Donald Trump would be able to shield conversations he had while he was president from federal investigators. In recent weeks, investigators have moved aggressively into Trump's orbit, subpoenaing top former White House officials, focusing on efforts to overturn the 2020 presidential election and executing searches of lawyers who sought to aid those efforts. The Trump team's discussions are with the U.S. Attorney's Office in Washington, D.C., which is in charge of the investigation, and its top January 6 prosecutor, Thomas Wyndham, the sources said. The conversations have not been previously reported. At this stage, the conversations are focused mostly on whether any communications that witnesses from the Trump West Wing had with the former president can be kept from a federal criminal grand jury under Trump's claims of executive privilege, the people said. The Justice Department has been anticipating a court fight with Donald Trump over executive privilege. The issue has arisen as grand jury subpoenas have been issued to two former White House counsels, office officials, and to former Vice President Mike Pence's chief counsel and chief of staff. Donald Trump's legal defense team has warned him that indictments are possible, sources have told CNN. Some members of Donald Trump's legal team have discussed his potential defense strategies on at least two occasions in recent months, according to two sources familiar with the matter, as they brace for new developments in the Justice Department probe and a separate investigation by Georgia officials into his potentially criminal meddling in the state's 2020 election results. Rolling Stone previously reported that Donald Trump has been briefed. Trump has grilled his attorneys on whether they actually believe he will face formal charges, according to sources. Yet the former president has expressed a heavy dose of skepticism that he will be indicted, one of the sources familiar with the matter has said. Another source close to the former president told CNN that Donald Trump also has posed questions about a potential indictment to members of his inner circle, some of whom believe the president is concerned about the possibility of federal charges. But one person close to Donald Trump said he is noticeably more engaged when he's chatting with friends and advisors about the 2022 midterm elections and his possible presidential campaign in 2024, that he has been during briefings on legal strategy. This person described the former president as dismissive in conversations about his legal troubles, often repeating his witch hunt mantra as he claims the various probes he's facing are plainly driven by political opponents. A Trump spokesperson said in a statement to CNN, there is clearly a concerted effort to undermine the vital, constitutionally rooted executive and attorney-client privileges through partisan political persecution. How can any future president ever have private conversations with his attorneys, with his counselors and other senior advisers, if any such advisor is forced, either during or after the presidency, in front of an unselect committee or other entity, and be forced to reveal those privileged, confidential discussions? The spokesman said. President Trump will not be deterred by witch hunts or kangaroo courts from continuing to defend and fight for America, our Constitution, and the truth. The U.S. Justice Department has so far declined to comment. In recent months, the former president has ignored advice from some of his advisers to avoid speaking with former and current aides who have become entangled in the House Select Committee's probe into January 6 and may become part of the criminal investigation, people familiar with the matter have told CNN. Donald Trump has specifically been counseled to cut contact with his former White House Chief of Staff, Mark Meadows, whose actions leading up to and on the day of the U.S. Capitol insurrection have been deeply scrutinized by the House panel, the people said. Two of Mark Meadows' former top aides, Cassidy Hutchinson and Alyssa Farrick Griffin, also have been highly critical of Donald Trump, with Cassidy Hutchinson testifying about damaging details about Trump's actions on 6th of January 2021. During her public testimony before the House panel in June. Hutchinson is cooperating in the Department of Justice probe as well. Some of Donald Trump's attorneys believe that Mark Meadows could also be in investigators' crosshairs and are concerned he could become a fact witness if he's pushed to cooperate in the Justice Department probe, according to two people familiar with the matter. In response, Meadows' attorney, George Terwilliger, told CNN on Thursday, "All of that is idle and uninformed speculation, apparently by people that know little but talk a lot." Former White House attorney Ty Cobb said, "Mark Meadows is perfectly positioned to be the John Dean of this mess," referring to the former Richard Nixon aide who offered crucial public testimony during the Watergate hearings. "The reason Mark Meadows is valuable is also the reason he is in jeopardy. He was basically at Trump's right hand throughout all these exercises and participated in key meetings and phone calls," Ty Cobb said. Yet, according to a source familiar with the relationship, Donald Trump and Mark Meadows have spoken a number of times. Another source close to Trump described their relationship as not the same as it once was while they served in the White House, but insisted they still maintained the relationship, even as Trump has complained about Meadows in his recent conversations with other allies. Mark Meadows has been known to attend fundraisers and events at the former president's Mar-a-Lago estate in Palm Beach, Florida, where he also helped organize a donor retreat last April for the Conservative Partnership Institute, a group he runs with former Republican Senator Jim DeMint. The securing of Trump's endorsement for U.S. Senate candidate Ted Budd was the last time that Mark Meadows was really around regularly. Since then, he's never been a big part of the political operation or Donald Trump's thought process, said a second person close to Donald Trump.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents. For humanity. Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio. And you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at the epic battle of Karbala and how it is related to human rights. The entire movement of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, from beginning to end, was revolving around human rights. So let us take the time to look at this movement of Imam Hussein and how it is related to human rights. First thing first, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, he lived as a member of society. He is not an extra terrestrial that came from a different planet. No, he's a human being like them. And being a human being and being a member of society, a member of community, is that you need to take the concerns of others as your concern. So when the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam says that the mu'mineen in their formation are like a wall, that if one part falls, the rest will fall, or he gives the example of a body, when one part of the body feels pain, the rest also feel pain. It means that each one of us needs to be concerned about one another. So Imam Hussein alayhi salam, since he's a member of this society, this community that he's in, that when he sees falsehood, when he sees oppression, when he sees people being hurt and harmed in any way, shape or form, he makes it his own, and he tries his best to overcome it and to fix it. So the mission of Imam Hussein began the minute Yazid, the cursed Yazid, took charge of the Muslim affairs. Now, let's back a little bit, right? Imam al-Hasan alayhi salam, he was a successor of his father, Amir al-Mu'mineen. Now, when Muawiyah, the father of Yazid, he took charge forcefully, and you know, we went with battles with Imam al-Hasan alayhi salam, and then him and Imam al-Hasan signed a treaty. This treaty, one of the conditions and the clause of this treaty was that if Muawiyah dies, or Imam Hassan alayhi salam dies, Imam Hussein to become the rightful leader of the Muslim world, right? Muawiyah agreed, he signed the treaty, and Muawiyah, what he did is, before he died, he made people submit to his son, Yazid, to be the ruler right after him. That was during his life. So he went and he broke his own treaty with Imam al-Hasan alayhi salam, which tells you which kind of person Muawiyah was. So his son came into power. Imam Hussein said, well, I can't allow that to happen, because Yazid, he himself, is not the type of person that preserves the rights of other people, not the type of person that would care about other people, not the type of person that he tries his best to make people happy. Actually, is the opposite. Yazid and Muawiyah, his father, all they did is that they deprived the Muslim and the Muslims of their rights, in terms of physical rights, in terms of wealth, in terms of economy, in terms of politics, even in terms of religion. They deprived people even from the right to speak their own mind and their own ideology. So it was a dictatorship at its best. When Imam Hussein saw that happening, he said, I cannot let that go, because I care about everybody, not just myself. Let us take a short break and then we'll continue right after.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We were saying that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, when he saw that Yazid, may Allah curse him, is coming into power and taking charge of the Muslim affairs, he understood that if he does not say anything, if he does not do anything, then obviously the rights of the Muslims, even though they were taken and the Muslims were oppressed at the time of Muawiyah, it will continue at the time of Yazid to even worse. The difference between Muawiyah and Yazid, the father and the son, is that Muawiyah used to pretend he was a Muslim. He used to pretend that he cares about the Muslims. He used to pretend that he gives people their rights and so on and so forth. He used to pretend that he prays, right? He used to pretend. To a certain extent, at least the people of Sham, the people of Syria and these, you know, neighboring countries, they thought, well, Muawiyah seems to be a good person. He's a Muslim and he's, you know, the Khalifa of the Muslims and he seems to pray and do the right things. I mean, even though he wasn't. But Yazid was publicly committing every transgression in the book in the front of the eyes of people. The people, they themselves, they could not handle it anymore. Right, so Imam Hussein alayhi salam, in his statement, he said, someone like me will never give allegiance to someone like Yazid. Why? And that the Imam, he gives number of things why Yazid should not be in power and why a person like Imam Hussein should never give allegiance to him. Why? Because he's a transgressor, because he commits sins publicly, because he deprives people of their own rights. So Imam Hussein, he said, it is now my duty to rise up against Yazid. So he first started the movement by trying to educate people and bring to the attention of people that now we are under the rulership of an oppressive dictator that you people need to revolt against, you people need to stand against. Now, the people of Kufa, obviously, they send their messages and invitations to Imam Hussein to say to him, look, obviously we can't accept Yazid, you come. And he said, sure, I will come. But Imam Hussein did not start his revolution because he was invited. It's because he saw it as it is his responsibility to help the rest of the Muslims, to ensure their rights are safe. Because if Yazid continues to be in power, then no one is going to be safe. No male, no woman, no child will be safe. And we saw that when Yazid first demolished the Kaaba, and we saw when Yazid invaded Medina in the incident of Al-Hurra, and how he killed the old companions of the Prophet, how he raped the women, and how he enslaved everyone. So Imam Hussein alayhi salam said, if Yazid maintains his power, and no one says anything about it, the rights of the Muslims will be taken. The rights of people will be taken. So he had to make that stand, first and foremost. So to initiate his movement, or the initiation of his movement, was based on human rights itself. Inshallah, we will leave it here and we will continue dissecting the uprising of Imam Hussein alayhi salam in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله
We are with you.
What about you? IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Britain's out of brace for a recession that will see five consecutive quarters of contraction and a decline in household incomes of 5% by 2024, the biggest fall since records began more than half a century ago. We now present you an article written by The Guardian columnist Jonathan Friedland. The piece is titled, Be Warned, Inflation could take British politics to a very dark place indeed. Winter is coming. The Bank of England says so. Pick your measure of the economic gale that is heading this way. Deepening a chill that's already biting hard. The Bank of England says inflation will reach 13%, shrinking the value of wages, making everything more expensive, starting with eating and heating, forcing yet more people to decide whether to starve or shiver. Britain's out of brace for a recession that will see five consecutive quarters of contraction and a decline in household incomes of 5% by 2024. The biggest fall since records began more than half a century ago. Of course, all of this will hit hardest those with the least. One in five UK households will be left with no savings at all by 2024. Meanwhile, the Centre for Cities says inflation is as much as 30% higher in the towns and cities of Northern England, thanks to poor home insulation and a car dependency that forces people to shell out more on petrol. You don't have to be a strict economic materialist of the old school to know all this will shape our politics, in ways both deep and shallow. Start with the latter and the current contest to pick Britain's next Prime Minister, a process of anointment mysteriously delegated to a select priesthood of 100,000 or so Britons who are anything but representative of the country whose fate they hold in their hands. By rights, the Conservative Party leadership race should be convulsed by the warning from Threadneedle Street, though of course the two contenders hardly needed recent forecasts to know the United Kingdom is already in a grave cost of living crisis. Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak should be preparing themselves and their party for the extremely tough task one of them will face in less than a month. But that's not how it is. Instead, Liz Truss continues to serve up soothing fantasy talk of tax cuts, even as she splashes the cash with spending promises on everything from defence to doctors' pensions. Cakeism, most famous exponent, may be in his final days as Prime Minister, but his doctrine lives on in Liz Truss. Rishi Sunak likes to pose as Mr. Sensible, insisting that immediate tax cuts would merely put fuel on the fire of inflation. But he is engaged in his own form of panda politics, telling the Tories' electorate whatever rubbish they long to hear. Unluckily for Rishi Sunak, we now have video evidence of quite how low he is prepared to sink in that endeavour, and how right-wing he actually is. In a garden in Tunbridge Wells in Kent, He boasted to local Tories of his efforts as Chancellor to reverse Treasury formulas that shoved all the funding into deprived urban areas, rather than to move deserving communities like theirs. That's right, it's Tunbridge Wells that needs the help. Nationally, surely, it will be a different story. You'd think no governing party presiding over an economic cataclysm of this order could hope to be re-elected. Runaway inflation, imminent recession, mortgages up, incomes down. Every political handbook says those are the circumstances in which incumbents get walloped by the voters. Keir Starmer should be miles ahead of the Conservative alternative, whoever it is. And yet, look at the recent opinion poll that showed that, in a match-up of Keir Starmer versus Liz Truss, it is Truss who is ahead by 2 percentage points. Labour is in front in other surveys, of course, but given this climate, it should be out of sight. Still, with an economic shock of this order, the impact will be felt far beyond Westminster and electoral politics. Deep in the Western folk memory is the knowledge of where hyperinflation can lead. Berlin wheelbarrows full of worthless banknotes as the precursor to Hitler. But what about a steep rise in inflation that is not on that Weimar level, but is a hike all the same? What will that do to Britain's politics? A rapid consequence could be a change in the public attitude towards the war in Ukraine. The most obvious cause of the current inflation surge is the rise in oil and gas prices, triggered in part by Russia's special operation in Ukraine. Standing with Kiev and sanctioning Moscow has come at a cost paid by regular people on the forecourt and in their heating bills. Up to now, Britons, along with most Europeans and Americans, have been solid in their support for Ukraine. But as inflation bites harder, they could shift, with new pressure on Kiev to end the war in any way, if that's what it takes to get prices back down. Public discontent may find another outlet. The first signs of the kind of disobedience movement that greeted the poll tax in 1990 are emerging, with a Don't Pay campaign urging consumers to refuse to settle their energy bills until the companies lower their prices. Energy retailers will stress that they are not the same as energy extractors such as BP, which recently announced it had tripled its quarterly profits to £7 billion, but few will be in the mood to make that distinction. An inflation rise of this order travels across class lines. Working people struggle because a galloping inflation rate turns even a wage increase into a cut. Meanwhile, the middle classes see any savings shrink before their eyes. If they are homeowners, their mortgage bills will soar, potentially out of reach. And when houses start getting repossessed, fear turns into fury. Where does that anger go? Guardian readers might hope it is directed at the act of self-harm that's made our current woes so much worse. I asked Albrecht Ritschl, Professor of Economic History at the London School of Economics, what single move the British government could make to alleviate the pain. The reply came, suspend Brexit for 20 years. He knows that's not going to happen, but he explains that today's crisis is not one of demand, but one of supply. There's just not enough stuff to meet demand, thanks in part to the post-COVID blockages in the global supply chain. In Britain, that's exacerbated because Britons can no longer import European goods as freely or as cheaply as before. In that context, policymakers are left with the question of distribution, how to share out the finite, indeed shrinking, amount that we have. The priority surely has to be with those who simply cannot afford to live. Restoring the £20 uplift to universal credit would be a start, but Professor Ritschl says, If you want to give something to the poor, then you have to do it like Robin Hood and take from the rich. In other words, not the tax cuts that Liz Truss is promising, but tax increases on the wealthiest. A wealth tax, a benefits rise, and a rethink on Brexit. There would be some comfort in imagining those as the consequences of this crisis. But I wouldn't hold your breath. Instead, memories stir of the last such inflation hike in the 1970s. That decade brought a surge in political violence and a rise in support for the racist far right in the form of the National Front. Under Boris Johnson, the Conservative Party has shifted towards a nationalist populism that Liz Truss seems unlikely to jettison. That creed is already of an ugly hue, but it could darken, especially when winter comes.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hussain Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, Hadith of the Day, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on Hadith of the Day, we're going to be looking at a very beautiful hadith, which has been narrated from Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam regarding Imam Hussein. As you know, we are in the month of Muharram. This is a very grave and sad time for all of the lovers of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. It's a time when we grieve and we mourn the martyrdom of the third Imam. And it is a very sorrowful day for all of the followers of the Ahlul Bayt, not only them, but also all of the people who are fond of the Ahlul Bayt and all of the justice-loving people who oppose tyranny and oppression, all of the freedom-loving people of this world, people who associate and affiliate themselves with this message of Imam Hussein. Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam said the following: when Hussein alayhi salam was born, Allah Most High revealed to Gabriel that a boy had been born to Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, and to descend to him to congratulate him and to tell him that indeed Allah's position with respect to you is as that of Aaron to Moses. So name him with the name of Aaron's son. Right? This hadith is interesting. It not only alludes to the virtue of Imam Ali alayhi salam, in the sense that it says that Imam Ali's position with the Prophet is similar to the position of Aaron with Moses. It's a very reference to a very famous hadith of the Prophet, Hadith Manzilat, which is often used as a reference to substantiate the imamate and the successorship of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Simultaneously, it's also a allusion to the virtue of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. So based on this affiliation and similarity between Aaron and Imam Ali alayhi salam, the angel Gabriel told the Prophet to name his grandson, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, with the name of the son of Aaron. So Imam Hussein's name is a